one of my first real life groans while watching a movie. I was a young lad. I was watching some like thriller about a mother on the run or something from something. I don't remember what it was. But what I do remember was at the end, when like her pursuer was dead or whatever, she was standing in front of a Safeway, the grocery store.
Yeah.
And the camera panned so that the way got blocked by something, so that it just said safe behind her head. And I was just like, gah, I'm 12 and this is too childish for me.
Is that the first movie you can remember watching and thinking, oh, this is bad?
No, because I was just an opinionated little jerk.
Wahoo! This is episode 224 of Insert Credit. It's a show where a panel of experts discusses a variety of video game topics, and typically a buzzer is somehow involved. I'm Alex Jaffe, and without specifying what it is, I would estimate that I am about 44% finished with the video game related project I've been working on most recently.
Wow. What am I working on? Okay. I'm Frank Spaldi, and I would estimate that I am, let's go for a clean 33.33 indefinitely percentage through the current project I'm working on.
That's a comfortable place to be, 33.33.
Third of the way. Not anybody's favorite Naked Gun movie, by the way, is the 33 and a third. Not the best one. The joke was funny for a while. Anyway, hello, I'm Tim Rogers. I am exactly 16.67% of the way finished with my current project, which I think everyone is probably quite familiar with. I'm not talking about the current episode. I'm talking about every episode that will ever be made.
All right.
I'm Brandon Sheffield, and we got a couple of projects going, so it's hard to choose one. I'd say we're about...
You got to lump them all together.
Okay, so if I average them,
yeah,
then we're probably at about 30%. But we got one that's around 85, 90. We got another one that's like 60 to 70. And then we got a bunch of other ones that are like sub 5% of the way along. So that's kind of somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there. I'm going to get right to it. I had a theme episode planned, but I threw it away because we need to talk about what the hell is wrong with Nintendo.
What do you mean, Jaffe? What happened?
I don't know if you're aware, but recently Nintendo announced their intention to delist all of their classic library games from the Wii U and the 3DS libraries.
Oh, that thing.
And strangely, they put out a statement that they have no intention to reissue these games.
I mean, okay.
Wait, did they actually do that? I'm not following any of this trash.
Well, they put out a statement that is not deleted, the entirety of it, but they did delete a part of it very quickly, like within like 20 minutes of posting it, that was essentially in the Q&A, someone asking like, isn't it kind of your responsibility to do this? And shouldn't you offer another way? And they just replied with like, we currently have no plans to offer classic content in other ways. Let me sum up my take on this, because this seems like a Frank question. So yes, Nintendo's taking down the servers and not allowing purchases, which I think is key, of Wii U and 3DS games very soon, and then sometime after that, presumably, even if you've purchased the games, you won't be allowed to download them anymore. And first thing I will say is that's business reality, everyone. That's just how it goes. Like that is the fate of all digital services for obsolete hardware.
Mm-hmm.
There's no getting around that, I don't think.
Yep.
So totally understand that decision. But we put out a statement at the Video Game History Foundation today. And essentially it's like, okay, we get that. But Nintendo's a member of the ESA, the Entertainment Software Association.
Mm-hmm.
And the ESA is a lobbying group that is actively preventing the preservation of video games by libraries and museums and institutions. They are actively fighting the notion of access to out-of-print digital games. So not only is Nintendo giving people no way to purchase these games, they are also preventing literally any legal way of getting these games in the future. And My take that I wouldn't put in a story, but I'll say here is that I think reading between the lines here, between that and the statement, I think Nintendo's just basically saying, yeah, these are the Pirates games now. So good luck.
Huh. So what you're saying is Minister Frank Cifaldi of the Video Game History Church here, you are absolved of piracy starting on X day. You should issue a statement like that for any digital titles released for the Nintendo Wii U or 3DS.
It is something that I tweeted something to that effect. Yes.
The Video Game History Church absolves you.
I personally absolve
Video
you.
Video Game History Pope.
Not every opinion of mine represents the company or whatever, and Kelsey keeps yelling at me not to tweet stuff like that, and I should probably listen to her.
But. You're the Pope, though. The Pope can say whatever he wants, and then everybody else at the church is like, that Pope, that's just him.
Yeah.
That's just him, I guess.
Well, but it's also officially like a statement from Catholicism.
I suppose yeah. So. Nobody really. In my house, we didn't always respect the Pope growing up.
Okay, all right.
That's not true. I don't know what that. I never mind. I don't want.
What non video game music would we play for the video game Pope?
Right.
Oh, it's. I think there's a couple of good ones you could play.
Yeah, I guess there's a couple of good songs out there.
Something with a trumpet. Let's leave it at that.
Something with a trumpet. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, that's me. Where are you boys at with this?
Well, the way I think about Nintendo is. Love their games, good people. Reggie, wonderful guy, CEO. Satoru Iwata, love that guy. If this is what they decided, I'm for it. I think it's probably for the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Reggie, beautiful face.
Well, I'm gonna go back then to spitting on the ESA here, because
keep going for it. Video game history Pope.
So, you know, every 3 years there is a hearing to essentially edit the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
To add amendments to it.
Right.
Devil May Cry a lot, as I call
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most recent sort of requests from institutions that were involved in this was the ability to offer digital access to completely out-of-print games. The only opposition to this was the ESA. And the ESA's stance is, well, it is theoretically possible that one of our clients might reissue a game. Therefore, the other tens of thousands cannot be available academically.
Yeesh.
Yeah.
That is where the law stands currently. Although there is a really fun little exemption here, which is libraries can provide access digitally to out-of-print software as long as it's not a game. So the ESA's argument is that researchers accessing software, they might do so in order to have fun. And that's literally what they said. And so the implication is that one cannot have fun with something that is accessed through a library system. And that is what stood. So that's where we are. Libraries cannot be used for fun.
You can't have fun for free.
No.
This is America.
Only cold academic study of software that is not a game. And also, what is a game? What is the legal definition of a game? We don't have one. There isn't one.
There's one way to get around that loophole.
I know it
though.
When I see it.
One way to get around that loophole, yeah. And I've been doing it since I was about 9 years old, and it is to just be learning everywhere you go. It's always, as long as you're learning all the time.
You're not having fun.
Yeah. They can't get you.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing is fun. Everything is a life experience for me. It's a real shame sometimes.
So where I stand on this is, of course, what I expect from Nintendo or any big company. In fact, it's much more surprising when a company like Sega says, like, go ahead and mod our Genesis games. We don't care if you do that. You can even sell them. You just got to give us a little cut. Like, that's pretty wild that they are doing that, and it's surprising and cool. I'm glad they are. It might be different if they had a current platform, though, I bet. For me, like, as soon as PlayStation Mobile disappeared and, like, the Vita was going away, I was like, go ahead and pirate Odeer and Gunhouse on there if you want to. Like, you have my blessing, because you can't get it otherwise, so go for it. It's going to be tough with the 3DS and the Wii U because so much of that experience is tied to the hardware. It's really unfortunate that, like, being tied to the hardware is what makes that software interesting, but it's also what kind of dooms it to future obscurity in a certain way. It's too bad. Like, you're always going to be able to play a Super Nintendo game on anything because it's just graphics on a screen.
Yeah.
But 3DS has a touch screen. It's got the 3D stuff. Mm-hmm. The Wii U has the separate controller with different information on it sometimes. Like, the dual screen aspect itself, you can emulate it okay. Like, you just have two screens stacked on top of each other, but it doesn't...
It's a terrible experience emulating the 3DS.
Yeah.
Was this not just the end game of this whole thing? Like, the most cynical people of all, amongst all of us, were saying back when Nintendo initially announced the Nintendo DS, the first DS, it was Nintendo is, they're trying to thwart the pirates, right? They don't want people to just be able to bootleg their games.
Right.
You have to at the very least own the Nintendo DS hardware in order to play DS games in a way that makes sense. Same goes for the Wii U. Same goes for the 3DS. They're two consoles that more or less require you to be playing the game on those consoles, as we're saying. And it's interesting that they choose to cut both of them off at basically the exact same time. Right.
It's been interesting to see that sort of ethos over time, because the arcade industry had to adapt to and adopt that methodology a little sooner, because people weren't going into arcades as much, because the arcades used to have the edge of graphics, and like they could have new boards which would get you better graphics faster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no longer the case. And we've hit basically a graphics plateau about 15 years ago in as far as stuff that's good enough.
Maybe you have, Brandon.
Wow. So to keep people going to the arcade, you get like the rhythm games that have unique controls. You get the Square Enix shooting game with the two guns that lock together and all that kind of stuff, so that you can only play it in that environment. And so that's the reason that you would come in there. So it's been interesting to watch the vector of change for certain console makers and arcade platforms trying to go that way, where Microsoft and Sony are basically like, yeah, we just made two big hot PCs that are affordable. And they're like not that different when you come down to it. They certainly don't have any extra cut touch screens or weird nonsense going on. No VR holograms like I thought they were going to do.
They do have those adaptive triggers on the PlayStation controller, though.
Yeah, they do. And they have the HD rumble.
Anyway, no one's going to save this stuff but all of us. That's what it comes down to. There's no there is no path within the capitalism system to preserving games in ways that will make the legal fetishists among you pleased to play these games. So read between the lines.
Avast me hearties.
I know this is a little late for this, but I would like to take umbrage with Brandon's comment that the Super Famicom is just graphics on a screen. Maybe to you, Brandon. To me, the Super Famicom is beautiful memories. Memories that are replicated seamlessly on my mister.
I was trying to avoid just saying Genesis for the fifth time, which is why I switched to Super Nintendo.
Genesis rules.
It does.
What games set in the present day at their release have best retroactively become period pieces?
Every Yakuza game, the end. Like, I'm playing Yakuza 5 right now, which is the longest and boringest one.
That's the one people don't like, yeah.
So far. I'm in Hokkaido. Or I think I'm in Hokkaido, I forget, in the snow festival, and there's like Snow Festival 2012 on there, and everybody's still got vestiges of flip phones going on, and it's just, you see brands that were there at that time, and it certainly rockets you back to a specific time of contemporariness, which I love, because all those Yakuza games came out like new, with new products and new sounds and whatever, and then you go and play the remaster 10 years later and it's like, yeah, I remember 2012, heck of a year.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Yakuza games are really good at that. There's probably some others, but that one does a great job.
I mean, it's hard to just come up with games that are contemporary ever. There's just not that many like real world analog games. I mean, the first one that my brain goes to, and I think this is going to be a lot of people, is Earthbound. And I do think it is sort of capturing a time where you used pay phones and had to get cash out of an ATM in order to make purchases. I mean, that's a little bit quaint now.
Yeah, that's fun. I like it. Back in the 1800s when Red Dead Redemption 2 came out, that was pretty...
Oh, yeah.
Red Dead Redemption 2 takes place in the 1900s.
Oh, heck. Sorry.
Owned.
So,
1903, I believe.
It embarrassing.
It is 1903. Yeah, that is true.
3 years before the earthquake.
The big one. TBO.
Yeah, that's all they talk about in this game. It's like, I'm really scared for that earthquake.
That earthquake's coming in 3 years. Yeah. I hope my house doesn't go on fire.
I hear the winds rumbling across the prairie about an earthquake. What's coming a couple years from now?
We don't need any earthquake proof, and this town's gonna last forever.
Horses are spooked again. Seems like a couple few years gonna be an earthquake.
Right, what other games take place in their time?
Batman, the video game for the NES.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Because Batman, the movie, took place in the same, wasn't it?
Oh, was it like the 1989 Gotham Centennial Parade or something? Jaffy, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty vague on purpose.
Okay. But that movie takes place in what if the 40s were happening right now?
Right.
Right.
I think, though, there's a lot that we can do with, for example, all the like cheaply licensed games on the Genesis, Super Nintendo, and TurboGrafx, like Yo Bro on the TurboGrafx, which has like those 90s Memphis style graphics on there with the title screens and stuff. I think that a lot of those represent the commercials of their era incredibly well. Like, yo, kids, come on down to the fun zone. And then like a guy skateboards by with sunglasses and then puts them down and winks at you and is like, don't tell mom. I think there's a bunch of those kinds of things. I don't know if it's worth discussing in less broad strokes than that, but yeah, they do a pretty good job.
All the ones I come up with are like Beavis and Butthead, Lester the Unlikely, Green Dog, the Beached Surfer Dude.
Yeah.
California games. There you go. That's the best game set in its time period that that is a good period piece. Because it's...
Oh, actually, what about sports games? It's weird to ignore those entirely because, you know, you get...
But there's not much
in
there except maybe like rules that changed later or something, you know? But
No, it's like athletes. You get your NBA Jam and all those players from the 90s that you know are in
fair.
There.
Okay,
NBA Jam, boom, shakalaka, he's on fire.
Yeah.
A good thing with the Beavis and Butthead game, I think it's the Super Nintendo one, is that one of the mechanics is searching payphones for change.
Yes.
So yeah.
Very of its time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Might be the Genesis one. I don't remember. The Game Gear one's a bizarre game. If you haven't played the Game Gear Beavis and Butthead, give it a spin. It's a really strange one.
I haven't. I will spin it. I'll see if it stays up for very long when I spin it.
Spin it, my friend.
Any games from the 80s about the Cold War?
There was that one called Cold War, but that was from the 90s.
Golgo 13, top secret episode.
Yeah.
Have you seen the cover for that game, Cold War, on the Sega CD?
No, let's look it up.
It's so good.
Oh, wow. Yeah, dude.
Yeah. It's it's Bill Clinton and Saddam Hussein shaking hands over like some planes flying. And Clinton is like kind of glad-handing looking into the camera like, man. And their arms are too long. It's I love it.
And the
so
phoenix
good.
Is manifesting in the background.
That's right. Oh, sorry. It's called the Third World War. Sorry, my mistake. It's not Cold War.
Third World War. Darn.
Next question.
Okay.
From software developer Hidetaka Miyazaki often speaks on his love for poison swamps.
He loves the swamp.
What's your favorite kind of environment in video games?
Mall. I like the mall. Should be more mall games.
Malls actually are pretty fun.
It's all about the airport.
Oh, yeah.
Set a video game level in an airport, and I'm pretty pumped and ready to go.
I like in Ninja 5-0, you fight through the airport, and then you're in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I believe that's a reference to Elevator Action Returns, where you fight through the airport, and then you're in a plane.
Probably it is.
And also has similarly sticky maneuverability to it.
Wait, is there an elevator in the plane?
What do you mean?
Oh, in Elevator Action Returns?
Yeah.
There's little lifts.
In Elevator Action Returns, the first level of the game is quite reminiscent of Elevator Action. You're going up and down in elevators. Whereas the rest of the game, it gets a little different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's still elevating platforms, but they're not like...
I'm picturing kind of Rolling Thunder, maybe, with the rest of it.
It's Rolling Thundery.
Yeah, I think Rolling Thunder, just basically anything that would be a Rolling Thunder level is a good level for me. A downtown, like, Southern California street would be a cool place for a video game level.
Well, it sounds like, based on this and the prior question, like, we like real world analog places in video games.
I like some fantasy ones too, though. I like myself a crystalline forest where there's like glowing gems. Give me some glowing gems. I like a good cave behind a waterfall that has some mystery to it. I like that.
Yeah,
sort of
like
thing.
Glowing water in a cave is always really nice. Yeah.
I like stuff with weird lighting. So like you're in a forest and there's all like aggressively over the top dappling of leaves and shadows and stuff. I feel like that's a chill zone. I like a river auto scroller scene where there's just like a nice sunset in the back and there's palm trees and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I like a castle. I like a church.
I'm okay with those. Those are just kind of like a lot of stones.
Yeah. Stones are good though, dude.
Well, like Resident Evil 4 is just like stones the game. Those two things work really well in there.
It doesn't inspire me though.
Bricks look good, man. I don't care. Bricks look real good when they're in a cool video game with bricks.
Yeah.
Oh, I like a 2000s lab where there's just like sterile white walls and things in beakers and weird syringes, and there's like a room and you can see into it from the window, and then you're like, "Oh man, there's going to be something when I go in there, I bet." I like those, even though they're kind of boring. I want to look at the weird decomposing guy on the gurney and have my character be like, looks like he had a bad day.
Mm-hmm. I like games that let you free look, even if it's in like camera mode, in side places that have bookshelves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And because I will read every spine, and not a lot of attention is paid to book spines and video games, I'll tell
Which
you
Which makes
that.
It fun.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there's just like flablablab. There's just typed nonsense.
Wow, they have the entire Lorem Ipsum collection.
I was trying to remember. I think it was... Yeah. Okay. In Spider-Man for PlayStation, there's an anthropology book called Ice the Goose.
Ice the Goose.
And there's like at least 8 different editions of it in one office.
It's not a straightforward process. It's a
wait, which Spider-Man game for which PlayStation?
PlayStation 5 or 4, sorry. This...
You talking about the Miles Morales?
No.
Frank, did you just brag about owning a PlayStation 5?
No, because I don't.
He said
don't
4.
Oh, well, he said 4 instead of 5. Or he said 5 first.
I did. And I believe that there is a 5 version of this
the
game?
Remaster, yeah. There's a remaster.
I just want to make sure if one were to go purchase it, they were getting the best one.
You got to make sure you get Ice the Goose.
I can't guarantee Ice the Goose is, like, they might have replaced, I doubt they replaced Ice the Goose. It's probably still in there.
Why would they?
Kind of a psycho would replace Ice the Goose.
It's a literary triumph.
Yeah, have you ever read it?
A literary triumph of anthropology books.
Wait, Frank, are you operating under the assumption that this book is not real? Because it is,
in fact, yeah.
I assume it's some kind of deep cut Marvel reference.
Oh, probably, yeah. There's not enough of those in the world.
Man, that would disappoint me, actually. I would be so disappointed if someone came in the forums later, which they may, and was like, actually, Ice the Goose is a reference to this specific frame of this comic.
Yeah, from Dan Slott's Spider-Man run.
Oh, man.
You clearly haven't iced a goose before. is the sort of thing someone would probably tell you, right?
Actually reading the Dan Slott run right now. So.
All right. I like a tower. I love a spire.
Spires are okay. I like to be able to jump on a big bell.
Clock towers are good.
Jump on a big bell's great.
Yeah, clock towers.
I mean, I could sit here and list level types all day. Though it all comes down to airport, Jerry.
Airport's good. I love the airport in Bullet Witch.
Airport in Bullet Witch is a good one. Bullet Witch also has a good sewer.
Does.
It sure does. My favorite sewer levels in Bullet Witch.
Bullet Witch has a fantastic, I've talked about this before, American suburb from the lens of a person from Japan.
Uh-huh.
Which the streets are like 5 times as wide, but the houses are like, these are actually kind of right, mostly.
This discussion may continue on another podcast.
Yes.
Here's my next question. Netflix recently announced that they're in the early stages of developing a BioShock movie.
Yeah.
No talent, writers, or directors are attached, which is always a good sign.
No talent will be attached, let me tell you. That's my theory.
Nice!
other than canceled, what do you predict Netflix's BioShock movie will be like?
Well, it's a movie, not a TV series. So the cool thing about this is that, I mean, I'm trying to be as nice as I can. It's the cool thing is that there's just not going to be the same level of criticism that there was about like the Cowboy Bebop show. So it's possible we'll get something like just wildly, weirdly, interestingly bad, or maybe something good. I don't know.
Well, I think they're going to have to. There's a magic trick to the game, right? Like there's the magic trick that everyone talks about, and I think they're going to have to adapt that to the screen. And I think the way they're going to have to do that is guy's going to look at the camera right when the movie starts and goes, "Would you kindly watch this movie?"
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
so there's I mean, it's been a long time now. The big twist of BioShock is that you are being mind manipulated by someone to do all of these murders and such.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that. Wow.
Well, some people haven't played it. The big twist is that your video game character that you're controlling is being controlled by a guy. In other words, the guy is basically you. But he's also a character in the game. So you, who are you controlling? The first person protagonist? Or are you controlling the guy who is using the brain control magic elsewhere in the game? Did you know about this, Brandon? Did I just spoil it for you? Hopefully I didn't. And I mean, hopefully I did. I hope you didn't know about this because it's good. Though it's, I mean, how are they going to do that in a movie? They just can't. Or they'll do it really stupidly and ham-fistedly. So maybe they'll just have to focus on the world-building stuff, which is was kind of cool. Now it's like, I don't know, it's kind of a hot topic sort of thing now, isn't it? It's about that dated. It looks like there's got to be hot topic BioShock t-shirts, right? I mean, who out there is like a die-hard BioShock fan who would be, I don't know, upset about the movie not being good?
I think they exist. I honestly think those people exist.
I think every BioShock fan, like earnest BioShock fan I've ever known, has like four children now. And, you know,
one of them is named Little Sister.
They don't have time to get like upset about stuff.
Yeah. Every time a new child is born, they have to decide whether to save or harvest them.
I'm the freak BioShock the scrutinizer in every neighborhood who's sitting around not having children and, you know, rewatching David Mamet movies 300 times. Like, maybe I'm a weirdo for thinking BioShock blows. I mean, it does. I mean, I can probably prove it.
No, I think people are coming around to that.
Are they?
I've been quiet during this segment because I've been racking my brain and my emails trying desperately to figure out the name of the person that I'm trying to talk about and failing, unfortunately. So there was a speaker at the DICE Summit, maybe like 10 years ago, who was a film director, and he was at the time a pretty hot property. And he was interested in doing a BioShock movie, and he was in talks for doing one.
Guillermo del Toro?
It was not Guillermo del Toro.
It literally was, though. I mean, he was talking about doing a BioShock movie.
There's a lot of talks. There's a lot of talks in Hollywood with a lot of people.
No, that wasn't him. So I don't think this was ever announced, but he was like, he got together a group of people, including myself, at DICE.
Oh, you're talking about a guy you met.
Yes, to ask us about what we thought would make a good BioShock movie and whether we would consult on it.
Brandon,
and I was like,
I'm sorry to break it off to you this way, but that guy's making crypto now. So
I'm sure he is.
Like, if a guy came up to you at a video game conference and asked for your input on a BioShock movie at any point in the past, he is an NFT crypto guy now.
Yeah, I think so.
It would be great if the BioShock movie came out and the whole stance was maybe objectivism isn't so bad.
But because I wanted to, you know, get the paycheck for the consulting.
Oh, you did it?
I wound up having to read part of one of those Ayn Rand books. And that was not fun.
That's Brandon Sheffield out there taking the money nobody else wants by doing something nobody should do.
Yes. It was different times, I think. I don't think I would have gone down the same road.
Might as well take that money, I guess.
At this point. But
wait, man,
then,
this isn't how you ended up on Google Stadia, is it?
No, it is not. It is not how. Hey, you know what? I might be on Google Stadia again, possibly.
Go because, for it, man.
Once the weird thing about Stadia, not to completely change it from change topic, is they're the only platform out there, as long as they still exist, that offers the developer a cut of the subscription.
Oh, that's weird, yeah.
I have one friend who made like a lot of money through that, and so, you know,
and that man, and that friend's name is Ken Levine. Is BioShock playable on Stadia?
Hang on now. So BioShock movie, it's on Netflix. Netflix has these interactive movie things, right?
Yeah.
So in the original game, since we're spoiling it, there's this really, really cool mechanic where, and Jaffe alluded to this earlier, where there's a little girl in front of you and you can not kill her and continue on with your life and get the ultimate reward at the end, or you can murder her on screen and get like a lollipop. And it really makes you think about your actions, you know, like, oh, do I want a lollipop right now? I think that in this movie, they're going to make you choose during the movie which path you're going to take. And if you kill her, it actually punishes you with 10 more minutes of movie.
Oh, God.
Nice.
That's my prediction for this movie.
That's a way to do it.
Here's one thing that I predict. In the like extras area where they have like episodes and more of Netflix, there will be audio logs that you can listen to that are just stage plays. If they were smart, they'd do it.
I like that. All right.
I mean, people talk all the time about how video game movies are no good, Jerry. They'll never be good. Nobody wants them, right?
Well, there's some good ones, though, now.
Well, people talk about this sort of thing all the time, right? They talk about how there's never going to be good ones. One of the things that is held up, people talk about how Peter Jackson was involved in a Halo movie. And how he wanted Neil Blomkamp to direct the Halo movie and how that didn't happen. They talk about these video game movies that would have been good if they had just been made by the studios too cowardly to make them or whatever. I feel like Guillermo del Toro's BioShock movie is the one I see mentioned the most. Are we all aware of this?
I'm aware of it, but I don't think I've seen that one mentioned more. I feel like the Blomkamp Peter Jackson Halo was mentioned the most.
God darn Guillermo del Toro's BioShock edges it out, especially because when The Shape of Water, his very strange movie about a fish man and a girl, won Best Picture, I remember seeing a really hilarious tweet that was like, I bet so-and-so feels real stupid right now for not greenlighting that BioShock movie. It's like, that was just like, there were many. I mean, I happened to be working at a video game website at that time that The Shape of Water won. I was maybe in a position unhealthily prone to see such comments. I just remember that being the funniest ever invocation of Guillermo del Toro's BioShock movie. Because it was so weird, first of all, that movie had won the Oscars. Yeah. Suck. So basically, BioShock the movie is gonna have to. It's gonna have to try real hard if it wants to beat Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water.
And it's not going to. We'll be right back after a quick break.
I'm gonna get some water.
Oh, some water, as in the shape of it.
What shape's that water gonna be, Brandon?
Yeah,
might be an ice cube. That's a shape.
That's one of my favorite. Genuinely, one of my favorite shapes.
It's a good one. I like a cube. I like an orb. Welcome back to Insert Credit. It's time for us to go to the dirt bag, where we select a question submitted by one of our listeners who subscribes to patreon.com/insertcredit.
One of our many Jerrys.
Yes, one of our many Jerrys.
Don't call them listeners, call them Jerrys. Because that way, whenever I say Jerry, it's I'm just addressing every single member of the listenership.
It's like a baby kangaroo is a Joey.
Yeah, a Joey. Our listeners are Jerrys. I think of my viewers as Jerrys.
So our Jerrys, they subscribe to patreon.com/insertcredit, where they get access to this form where they can submit their own questions, and they also get regular bonus episodes and other fun surprises. This week's question comes from Bready to Die,
who
asks, when is auto-saving better than manually saving, and vice versa?
I manual save all the time. I don't care. I'm just kidding. I think autosaving's legit.
Yeah, I think autosaving's pretty cool. And in the grand majority of games, I would prefer if it would autosave for me all the time. The only time I don't like autosaving is when there's like a, and you can't go back from this point and do the rest of the side quests.
Oh, yeah.
If you autosave me over there, then that's a no thanks. But I don't know. I think the kinds of games where auto-saving are less relevant are things where you're trying to do a specific task and get better at it, and you need to repeat things, and so you should save from a specific point and get better and get all the way through. But most of the time, I really think just auto-save me up. I don't need to have a complicated time with this. Just let me go.
I mean, I use the manual saves only if I'm not sure about a decision that I'm about to make. What else are you going to use those for?
I use them when I'm going to stop playing for the night to be just extra sure that I don't lose my progress.
Yeah, I do that too. That's true.
Yeah, that's the main one.
And every time it's like, are you sure? It's been 3.5 seconds since your last save that you, if you want to quit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, those Yakuza games, talking about them again, I don't know why you have to go through like 5 million save screens. I mean, I do know why, but they could streamline it a little bit. You got to save, choose whether you want to overwrite your save, yes, no, then it does a big save thing, and then it's like, okay, now we're going to save your system data, okay, now we're doing that, now we're going to save this other data. It's like, just put it all in one thing, please.
They just want to make sure that you know
who's in charge.
Know where all the data's going.
Yeah.
So you don't have any questions.
I appreciate that to an extent, but they could just have like a screen one of three or something and just go through it.
I think, I talked a lot about the auto saves and the manual saves in my review of Cyberpunk 2077 and how I had over 100 manual save files, how the game is all about decisions and there's all these decision points in the game where you get to choose such and such thing over such and such other thing. And I feel like sometimes they're a little gutless where they give you a choice. You got all these manual saves, and it's like after the point of no return in Cyberpunk, they drop an autosave on you, right? And they're like, oh, you're saved here. Can't save during this mission. But it's like, oh, I mean, I got a million manual saves, and I can roll back any like decision in the game over the course of the last act. They put all of this emphasis on choices and such. I think my favorite example of a game that autosaves and also has manual saves harmoniously, it's Final Fantasy 14, where the game is, it's an MMO, so it is autosaving all the time, right? So, you know, there's no cheating with your save data or your decisions that you make or whatnot. But at the same time, when you log out of the game, you can do so in a hotel room, which gives you a bonus the next time you log on because your character has rested or gone to sleep, which is something I was doing all the time in Red Dead Redemption and Cyberpunk. I was making my character go to bed before I turned it off.
Oh, yeah, I do that all the
time. Which I think is fun, which is like a double manual saving, basically. I mean, the game is auto-saving, but I'm also manual saving and also putting my character in a bed before turning the game off. So it's anything that makes it more fun for me. Anyway, Final Fantasy 14 lets me put my character in a bed and turn the game off, which is not a manual save. But it gives me a bonus, so it sort of is. So I think, in other words, the answer to this question is autosaves and manual saves are best when they're in harmony.
Tim, you reminded me of how I kind of like some of the older games like Shining Force, where they ask if you want to save, and then after that they ask if you want to keep playing.
Yeah.
If you say no, then they're like, oh, well, good night, or have a nice day, or whatever.
That is a Dragon Quest holdover, I believe.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because those Shining Force individuals were, they were big Dragon Quest buffs.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, even down to like you save at a church in Dragon Quest, and that's always very fun. It's very pleasant in a Dragon Quest.
Yeah, I like in Shining Force, the book framework, where it's the whole thing is being read to you by a little elf child.
Strange little elf child, yes.
Strange little elf child is reading the book to you, and they're like, oh, which chapter do you want to continue from?
Love that stuff.
Yeah.
Just give me all that, Jerry.
How do you balance making the player more powerful as a game progresses while increasing the game's difficulty?
Yeah, well, that's one
of the bigger challenges
in video games. That's pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah. How do you make a good video game?
It's a good question.
Skateboards.
My feeling is that you've got to have a little push and pull. It, I mean, it depends on the type of game, but for a lot of them. So like you start in a zone and you're a little less powerful than the enemies that are there and you got to work for it. And then by the end of the zone, you get more powerful than them. And if you ever return to that zone, you're way more powerful than them. And so you can feel your progression. Mm-hmm. And so that's like kind of a basic template that can be followed. So you kind of get more powerful in the middle of a thing so that at the end of it, you're like, yeah, I'm done here. So you get to feel more powerful and then less again. And then there's always a greater challenge and that kind of stuff. That only works for certain kinds of things, I guess.
I would say the answer is, as Frank suggested, skateboards. Because in the game Jack 2, for example, one of the best video games, in my opinion, that's ever been out there, you get a skateboard, you get a hoverboard later at a point about maybe 18, 19% of the way through the game. You can then use the skateboard to traverse the open world in the game quite triumphantly with wonderful, refreshing speed. Yet there are then platforming segments in the levels that require you to be using this hoverboard to be doing quite daring, horribly frustrating tricks. I think that's an interesting way to make the player more powerful, but also make the game more difficult.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure. I was pretty sure that's where you were.
Specifically talking about Jack 2.
So much of the making characters more powerful and then making enemies more powerful thing, it ultimately winds up being like everyone's at the same level all the time and it's pointless.
It's escalation, man.
I've definitely thought about, like, what if there was a game that just made the visual numbers go up but didn't actually change anything? Like, it's like, now you're level 2 and the enemies are level 4 now, but it didn't actually change. I remember there was this one Final Fantasy, I can't remember which one it was, though.
8?
It was a spin-off where they were like, all the enemies will dynamically raise their level along with you. And it's like, okay, so everybody's the same level as me all the time? Why even bother having leveling? There's this article that went around about it was a game by, I think, Psygnosis, and it was a racing game, and I can't remember what it was called, but it wasn't very well received. Oh no, it was by Bullfrog.
Same thing.
They had to make it in like 3 weeks for the PlayStation. This ridiculously impossible task. And so they initially intended to have all the craft that you could play. It was like a kind of a hovercrafty thing, have different stats. And they visually kept that you had different stats and they were all different, but under the hood they were all the exact same car and had the same power, same drifting, same whatever. But just having those visual differences there, saying that this had more acceleration, this had more whatever, people still had preferences for which car they felt like was the best, even though they were actually truly identical. And I think about that one a lot.
It's like the M&M flavors conversation.
Yeah, it's all smoke and mirrors, god darn. It's just a different colored M&M.
Exactly. So my favorite answer to this question is, I was just I've been sort of playing the game The Last of Us again, by which I mean I've been watching Mimsy play it, and The Last of Us actually kind of gets easier as it goes on, and the player gets more powerful, and by the fact that your assistant, your secondary character, becomes useful during the game. She, like, at a certain point in the early middle of the game, will start killing other, like, enemies. Like, if a guy grabs you, she will come up behind him and stab him, like, once every 2 minutes or so. You get, like, a free stealth save, which is fun. That's the game sort of plateauing its difficulty. This is the inverse of the answer to the question. It's a game, like, plateauing the difficulty while also making the player more powerful and making that actually narratively and structurally and mechanically meaningful. And that's beautiful that they didn't even try to make the game get like harder. Just made it part of the story. Of course, some critics said that the combat was samey and the difficulty plateaued, which was such a weird criticism because it was clearly on purpose. The end. Thank you.
Perfect.
The game I was thinking of was High Octane. I think it's so weird when people are like, yeah, it's too bad that this game isn't really hard. And I just don't understand that mentality.
Yeah.
Like, what do you, who are you trying to gatekeep, yourself? I mean, like, you need this to be more of a frictionful experience for you. I don't know. It's kind of strange.
Anyway, can we all agree that the skateboard in Hudson's Adventure Island is terrible?
Oh, skateboarding in Adventure. Yeah, it's not that good. It's
not a good skateboard.
It's good that you can slow down in it, but. That's
I'm pretty good at that skateboard, TBH.
We're revisiting a segment right now. I want all of you to review Super Mario Brothers 2 in 6 minutes.
Which one?
Oh my god.
The American one.
American one. Okay.
The American one.
I believe we call that Super Mario USA in these parts.
It's called Mario Madness.
I call it Super Mario Brothers 2 because it's the only one that I played and I like it.
I think Super Mario Brothers 2 is the favorite Super Mario Brothers game of people who are performatively like anti-Nintendo.
I knew this was going to be a thing about me.
Yeah, I mean, it is though. It is like you'll see people be like, "I don't care for Nintendo, but I love Kirby," right? Yeah. Where it's like they want to launch into taking a dump on Nintendo. I'm all for taking a dump on anybody, especially a company that murders their own legacy. So
Super Mario Brothers 2, I like
Doki Doki Panic.
Yeah, the Doki Doki Panic. I like how much kind of weirdness there is in there. I like the hidden doors. It gave me the feeling as a player that there was kind of a lot of potential and there could be things anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the spirit of Super Mario Brothers, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
I mean, to be honest, I think the in the first Super Mario Brothers, that spirit is somewhat of a mean spirit. Like invisible blocks that you have to jump and touch with your the peak of your jump in order to reveal them. Super Mario Brothers 2, Mario Madness, Super Mario USA, Doki Doki Panic. It's complete title, by the way, is a game where they actually kind of keep a lot of the weird promises of the original Super Mario Brothers, where it executes on these little tiny ideas, right?
And it feels a little more exploratory than punitive, the weird little secrets that you find. There's something special for you rather than here's a secret way to get punished.
You know, all three of the main lines, the Marios on the NES, like explore out of bounds places in different ways. So like the first one is there's stuff below and above the screen. The second one is like there's a mirror world and there's more stuff back there. And then the third one is like you can go behind stuff, you know, and I think there's a really interesting through line there. Something that I find kind of remarkable about Mario 2 from a tech perspective, if you kind of understand like the ROM size limitations and stuff like that, is that it does a remarkable job of convincing you that you're going to a bunch of different places using just a small handful of tiles and like tricks. It's really interesting.
It is. And one thing that charmed me about it was the differences between characters and their movement, because the differences are quite subtle. It's like Luigi runs faster.
Luigi does not run faster.
He doesn't? Oh, he jumps higher.
Yeah, he jumps higher. And he jumps higher and slower. You know, one interesting thing about the different characters in Super Mario Brothers 2 is anytime there's a discussion of the game, people bring up the different characters, but with this weird contentious air, like oh, there's I love the characters in Mario 2. Peach is the best, obviously. People get all like New York versus Chicago pizza about defending their favorite Mario 2 character. And it's like, clearly it's Toad, like, duh. Like, duh, Toad is the best.
You can pick up turnips faster.
Yeah, you can pick everything up faster, and that's how you get all the extra lives that you're going to need if you're playing exclusively as Toad, is because you can pick up all the coins and then win the slot machine at the end of the round.
But couldn't you say that the game is balanced for Mario?
Yeah, Mario's right in the middle, yeah. It's Mario in the Middle is the one of the alternate names
of it. So wouldn't the platonic Super Mario Brothers 2 experience be a Mario playthrough?
Probably. I mean, I played as Mario. So the cool thing, like, I remember my neighbor in Wichita, Kansas, getting Mario 2, which he referred to as Mario Madness, like, constantly, because it said Mario Madness on the box. We got Mario Madness. You want to play Mario Madness? You want to play Mario Madness? Like, I remember him
y'all got that
like,
madness?
Like, trying to figure out what strategy, like, which character was correct for which levels, and, like, being very strategic and detective style about it. And I remember the schoolyard conversation at the time, around the time I got yelled at by a kid for not having Keith Courage.
It's fun to me that would be something to yell about. You don't have Keith Courage?
Yeah, that seems like a parallel shadow world after you throw the potion kind of place to be. Yeah.
This kid was, his name was Jared. He was in sixth grade. And
oh no,
and it's not the Jared. He was in sixth grade, okay. And he had a TurboGrafx, and he was just really angry about it. And he was a bully, plain and simple. Though I just remember kids in the schoolyard strategizing about the four characters. This was before, so an iconic Mario 2 playthrough is Mario, sure, but Mario wasn't that iconic back then. Mario was just, he was a guy from one video game. A lot of kids encountered Super Mario Brothers 2 around the same time that they encountered Super Mario Brothers 1. Kind of an interesting way to think about it.
I thought about that recently too. That's a, I think a lot of the youngsters don't understand that. It's like one was a contemporary game for like,
right,
like 8 years or something.
Yeah, but the graphics difference between Mario 1 and Mario 2 is like, I mean, it's like NES and Sega Master System, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, Mario 2 is the most Sega Master System Mario game.
It's the best looking Mario on the system, and I think it's because there is a dedicated eyeball sprite that has its own color palette, and it just makes such a huge difference.
The game had a real expressive look. It kind of... It doubled down on having like a personality and an aesthetic. So it's like Shigeru Miyamoto was not married to Mario yet at that point, right? So how cruel, in fact, those business powers of Nintendo to tell the man, yeah, you got to just, we're going to put Mario on him for America. Who cares?
I bet it actually started as a Mario game.
It might have.
Huh.
Because, I mean, he said multiple times that that's his process, that, like, Mario's his stand-in character.
Yeah.
So I'll bet it started that way, and then they did the tie-in with... do either of you know, it's actually a festival. Doki Doki Panic is based on, like, an annual festival or something where people wear those masks like the Shy Guys. And this was, like, the...
Oh, really?
This was, like, the official game of that year's festival. I just don't, you know the name or anything like that.
Doki Doki Panic is a real... It sounds unique to us, though... As English speakers, though, if you spend a little time learning the Japanese language, it's like, that's kind of a really boring title for a game.
What's Doki Doki? Just a heartbeat?
Yeah, it's just like heartbeat sound. Yeah. It just means...
It's the sound of a heartbeat, okay.
Yeah, it's kind of a nothing title for a game.
What's the difference between Doki Doki and Tokimeki?
Well, one of them is a word and the other one is an onomatopoeia.
Fair enough.
So would a translation just be like anxiety? For Doki Doki Panic.
Yeah, basically it's like panic.
It's called panic attack.
Doki Doki is like the sound of a heart beating.
Right.
So actually Mario Madness is a pretty good translation.
Yeah, except for the lack of Mario in the original. Right. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's just madness. Panic madness. So I would ultimately, for the purposes of this podcast, conclude that the bottom line here is that Super Mario Brothers 2, Doki Doki Panic, Mario Madness, Super Mario USA is the bonk's revenge of Nintendo.
Wow. I like it.
It is the most bonkish PC Engine / Sega Master System, Sega Genesis feeling video game that Nintendo ever made. They just so happened to make
it the most Hudson-y Nintendo game, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, back before Nintendo had really codified all of their design language, back before they started just putting Kirby. It would have been a Kirby game if they'd had Kirby at that point.
Probably.
That was Nintendo's weirdest time. That was the disk system era, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like Doki Doki Panic and then those like detective adventure games and stuff like that. Like that,
that's
a strange time for Nintendo. And then
Zelda 2.
Famicom Murder Club.
Yeah, and there's the time travel one.
You know those are on the Switch now.
I do know that, but the time travel one isn't. And there's the sort of like Edo period Japan adventure game too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was Sakamoto even. So like it's an odd time for Nintendo that is not, well, like almost none of it's translated except for the Murder Club. And then when they went back to cartridges, it was just kind of like, okay, Mario 3, make it like one, but better. So
Mario 3 rules, dude.
And I just want to throw in, I'm not going to do the Mario voice, but when I was listening to Tim say Mario Madness a few times, something that popped into my head was Mario in the Charles Martinet voice screaming One Step Beyond. And I'll just let you play that in your head.
It's pretty Mario Madness.
Pretty good. All right. We have time for one more question. Write the first sentence and the last sentence of a textbook about video games.
Shoot.
We've come a long way since Pong. That's the first sentence.
And then the last sentence is, we've come a long way since Pac-Man.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's something like, okay, so what exactly is a video game? And then the last sentence is, we'll probably never know what a video game is.
I feel
that's pretty good.
I feel like a good opening sentence would be, I mean, it's boring, but something like, everybody plays games. So you just start out with that expectation of universality.
Okay.
I think the last sentence should just be, crypto.com.
Yeah.
That's a reference to all the Super Bowl ads that had crypto in them.
Yeah.
The Larry David one, for example. Did you all see that
Larry one? David did one?
Oh, it's very disappointing.
That was such a good commercial. And then it's like, oh, they got Larry on crypto.
It was a really good commercial.
Yeah, that's the worst part.
Yeah, it was one of the best.
Like, you can understand why he did it.
One of the best commercials I've ever seen. You want to know what's real nice about rich people? Just like the actual nicest thing about rich people is how they're always just offering to get you in on it and make you rich with them. That's my joke about crypto.
Yeah.
They're always, they just really want you to be rich too. They do everything they can.
That's totally normal rich people behavior.
That's how you know crypto's real, dude. That's how you know.
I do think any discussion, you said video game history, right? That's the book?
No, I said a video game textbook.
Oh, just a textbook. Okay. I think either way, like, it's interesting to just start with what is a video game exactly.
Right.
As far as the ending, I don't know. I think I'm just sticking to my guns. I think I'm onto something there.
Can I actually write the first paragraph?
Go for it.
So here it is. Imagine a button. What happens when you press it? Welcome to video game design. And then the last sentence is crypto.com.
Yeah.
I think on that we have to end the show. Does anybody have any recommendations?
Because we talked so long last time, I didn't bother. Well, none of us did a recommendation last time, I think.
No.
Right.
So what I wanted to recommend was Resident Evil 4 HD, which is a fan patch that is remarkable. It replaces, I believe, literally every texture.
I think it's every texture, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's actually every texture is replaced, not by like a reimagining, not by like making it more photorealistic. These two guys spent 8 years and they logged their hours. I believe it was a little over 10,000 hours, painstakingly recreating every texture to look as if it was the original before they crunched it down to fit on to fit in the GameCube's video memory, essentially. So sometimes that is redrawing very carefully. I think that's most of it. But sometimes it meant getting on a plane and like going to the church where the artists photographed bricks and finding the exact bricks and re-photographing them.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did these people have the resources for this?
One of the guys was in Spain, right?
Oh, that would do it.
I thought that maybe they both were, but I didn't look into it. Yeah, I think at least one of them, I think, is in Spain. Yeah.
I think one of them's a U.S. boy and the other's a Spain boy. One of the guys works for a bank. I don't know. It's kind of a great... I believe one of the guys, the project began when one of the guys was looking at a wall in his Spanish hometown and thought it looked familiar. And then he photographed it and realized it was in Resident Evil 4. And then he realized his town had two walls from Resident Evil 4. And then he decided to find the rest, the other 10,000. That's a joke. I don't know if that's true. But I think
that would be cool if it were.
I was compelled. I don't know.
I'd like it.
I'm writing the Netflix movie adaptation of Resident Evil HD, The Story.
The result is that it looks exactly like you remember Resident Evil 4. You know, you kind of play it and you're like, what's the big deal? But if you go like look at the original tiles again, you're like, oh.
Or if you just launch the Steam executable for
right without patching it. Yeah.
For like the 5 minutes or what, the 1 minute you need to launch it before, like, to make sure you have the right version number.
You can switch back to the original tiles in the options.
Oh yeah, you
can't
just toggle them off.
Well, yeah. You have to restart the whole game to do it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You can't just like, you know, hit select to go back and forth, which would be really cool. But they did that, they fixed some of the bugs as well, and reintroduce some of the things that were accidentally removed or misplaced after porting it from the original GameCube version. So it is the master version of Resident Evil 4, and it's fantastic, and I can't recommend it enough. 60 FPS cap, though, which is not their fault.
Yeah, it's there were like some sort of a frame rate dependent things in there, right? Yeah. It's still 60 FPS, I'll take it.
Yep.
You know, why not?
It's my turn.
Yes.
I'm going to recommend a show on the Netflix.
Uh-oh.
Of all places. I know.
Oh, home of Bioshock.
Or home of Bioshock the movie.
Yeah. It's called Bioshock. It's called Green Frontier.
GFT.
This is a show that I haven't seen anybody talk about for some reason. I don't really know what's up with that. It's like a hard-boiled detective thing, but with magical realism and starring a lady and set in the Amazon. And it's a movie where, it's not a movie, it's a show where just about everything is done a little differently from how you might expect. Slower paced, it's less physically violent, the sources of people's strengths are a little different. You got to keep the magical realism thing in mind when you go into it, because otherwise it could be, feel a little weird. But it's, if this had been season two of True Detective, for example, everyone would have been like, well, this is the greatest series of all time. The ending, this is not exactly a spoiler, but it's one of those things where I feel like the writing and direction and cinematography was so well done and so well put together that they could have put together like a conclusive ending, but they did one of those open-enders.
Oh, so they can have a second season or what?
It's. I don't feel like it was even for a second season. I feel like they made a choice that just didn't 100% work there. And I feel like I got to say that in advance because I think some folks, once they get there, could be a little disappointed otherwise. But it's a really good show. It's in Spanish and then various indigenous languages to the Amazon region. And it's just really... it's really neat. I haven't seen another show quite like it. All the IMDb reviews are complaining about how it's slow or how the big twist they didn't like. I don't know what the big twist was because I didn't see one. I thought it was going right along in one direction and kept going there.
And to you, it wasn't slow because you don't watch all the Marvel movies on repeat.
That's right.
Not to keep
but
picking
it, you know, on. just gorgeous cinematography and very well framed and paced for my money. And I think it's really cool, and you should check it out. It's called Green Frontier, The End.
Is it available on Fandango?
I don't know if it's on Fandango anymore. Me and Fandango have had a falling out.
Oh, no more Fandango. Brandon hates Fandango.
Oh, the sponsorship fell through.
Yeah, that's what happened.
My recommendation for this week is quite simple. Buy Bitcoin, crypto.com. That's a joke. Don't do that, please.
Nice.
Don't do it. And also I would recommend people stop asking me to help them with crypto. Stop asking me about NFTs. Stop asking what I think. A gentleman, I'm going to go ahead and pejoratively refer to him as a young man, emailed me just yesterday saying that my silence on the topic of NFTs is perhaps read by some of my audience as tacit endorsement. My failure to renounce. He said renounce and denounce. He mixed his nounces. You can't denounce. You can't renounce something you didn't announce, right? He told me it's read as tacit endorsement on the part of not just me, but some other of your fans. I think basically everybody's got to just get off of the internet, just period. I only look at my emails so that brands can apologize to me. Get off the internet. Don't buy crypto. That's my recommendation for the week. Thank you.
All right. There was a comic book that came out in 2019 called Dog Days of Summer. There's a pretty good Crypto the Superdog story in there. So that's my crypto recommendation.
Is it about DDoS attacks because of this having the same acronym?
It must be. My other recommendations are that if you're listening to the show on any platform where you can subscribe to or review podcasts, that you do that to keep the algorithms pushing us to the forefront. You could also go to patreon.com/insertcredit where you could become a patron to submit your own topics, listen to monthly bonus episodes, and get other exclusive treats. You could also join us on forums.insertcredit.com where a pretty obtuse game is going on right now that I don't know the rules.
I haven't figured it out yet myself.
And follow us on Twitter for our own personal updates and projects. The show is at Insert Credit. I'm at Alex Jaffe. Brandon is at NecroSofty. Frank is at Frank Cifaldi. And Tim is at 108. This show is edited by Esper Quinn with music by Kurt Feldman. I'm Alex Jaffe.
I'm Frank Cifaldi.
I'm Tim Rogers.
I'm Brandon Sheffield.
And you have now saved your game.
All right, I got good news. So that tweet that I did, after 4,900 retweets, we finally got a $1 patron.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, wild.
Working our way up, boys.